Okay, well, thanks for having me here. The work I'm going to talk about was done by myself with my postdocs Seth Yu and Scott Hsu, and grad students Gunsu Yun, Deepak Kumar, Steve Pracco, and Carlos Romero. So the experiments involve ideal MHD, more or less, but I'll understand it in the context of these equations, and I'll refer back to them later. And the method of the experiment is to try to simulate the important dimensionless numbers as best as possible, and in particular try to get the Lundquist number to be large and the beta small, although recently we thought maybe the beta is getting large in certain situations, but at least the idea was to have beta small. And then the next thing is to simulate the boundary conditions to try to get the geometry similar to the astrophysical case. So here's the boundary conditions that we work with. We have a central disk that's surrounded by an annulus, and they're coplanar, and we have a poloidal magnetic field that links the disk to the annulus. And then we apply a voltage between the disk and the annulus, so there's an electric field that's roughly in the radial direction, and that will tend to drive a current which will tend to flow along these magnetic field lines. So that's the general geometry. And so we claim that this is at least geometrically similar to the astrophysical case, and maybe we can do some things that are interesting.
Do you have any shear, any motion?
Well, let me give the talk. We'll see. Okay, so here's the setup picture of it. There's the central disk and the annulus, and you see there's a number of holes in both the disk and the annulus, and those turn out to be rather important. We inject gas through those holes because we figured you've got to have gas to make a plasma. You can't make a plasma out of vacuum, and we could have had a pre-fill in the vacuum chamber, but this came from Sverimac lore, and on Sverimac lore, we knew that gas injection was an issue, so we decided to do it this way. And if you turn this around and look in the backside, there's a coil on the backside, and that coil makes the poloidal magnetic field that links the disk to the annulus. And then there's tubulations going to those holes, and we have gas puff valves that can open quickly and squirt out some gas. And so that's what it looks like. So here's a picture of the actual thing, and you can see the disk and the annulus and the holes on the disk and the holes on the annulus. And these are some copper tubes carrying gas to the outside holes, and then there's some other tubes on the inside going there. And the disk and the annulus are electrically insulated from each other, so we can put different voltages on them. The annulus is at ground potential, and the disk can be at high voltage. And there's a very narrow gap there, and we're playing some games with something called the passion curve, where we're to the left of the breakdown limit of the passion curve, so actually it doesn't break down where the gap is, because the gap is too narrow for breakdown. Now here's a side view. The blue is the disk, so that's what's at high voltage. Here's the coil. Here's the poloidal field lines. The green is the annulus, and here's some gas feeds coming in, and these are the gas feeds here. And this is a magnetic probe that we use sometimes. And this is floating. This is a ceramic insulator that allows it to float, so we can put high voltage on the inner part. And here's the scale of it. It's about 1.4 meters in diameter, and the whole thing is almost 2 meters long. And here's a picture of it. So here are some nominal parameters. These are obviously very different from astrophysical parameters, so unless you've worked in the lab, you probably don't have any sense for them. But these parameters are parameters that are typical of gadgets called Sverimacs, which are fusion devices. And the technology for this is relatively easy and straightforward, or at least we have lots of experience with it. So we work on a fast time scale that allows us to have the flux frozen into the plasma. It can't leak out. Our magnetic fields are a few hundred gauss. Our currents are rather high, of the order of 100 kiloamps. Our voltages are fairly high too. We start with several kilovolts and then it drops. So our pulse power is in the hundreds of megawatts, very high power. And we work with a variety of gases to try to see what the effect of different masses are. Originally, we were working with hydrogen, and then lately, we've been trying heavier gases. Our densities can be all over the place, and recently, we saw we can get extremely high densities for lab plasma, 10 to the 22 per cubic meter, 10 to the 16 per cubic centimeter. The scale lengths are nice human scale lengths, 5 to 50 centimeters. The betas were much less than 1, but we think when we get these really high densities, they might be approaching 1. And the Lindquist number, we think, is nominally of the order of 1,000 or so. So the sequence is something that we understand. We didn't really understand at first. We just saw how interesting, and then after a few years of work, we finally realized what was going on. So we start with high vacuum in this region. There's nothing here. It's emptiness. And we energize the magnet on a slow time scale. So you can think of that as being almost a steady state field. That's done on a 10 millisecond time scale. So it's like 1,000 times slower than everything else. And these electrodes are copper, so this magnetic field can seep into the copper electrodes on the millisecond time scale. But on the time scale of the experiment, the flux is frozen into the copper. Okay. So that's how we get our poloidal flux going. Then we squirt in neutral gas with our gas valves, and we've measured this with a fast ion gauge, and we find that the density is very high around here, and then it falls off, and it has a roughly conical pattern. So there's lots of neutral gas density just here, but over here it's pretty much emptiness, and that's an important issue there. So we're not pre-filling the vacuum chamber with gas, and we're not going to be neutralizing a pre-fill of gas. Okay, so here's the sequence of steps that we see. First thing we see are some very distinct arched loops that go from a nozzle on the inside to a nozzle on the outside, and they seem to be following the poloidal field lines. In fact, I mean, we know they are because we calculate that. So we apply our high voltage, we apply our 5 kilovolts or so, it breaks down, the voltage will drop to about a kilovolt after breakdown, and it sits roughly around a kilovolt after that. And we see these very distinct arches. So here's a picture of them. You can see that they're 8 of them, because we had 8 holes on the inside and 8 holes on the outside, and somebody dubbed them the spider legs, and that seemed like a good name, so we stuck with that. And one of the things there are a couple of things that's interesting about them, is that why do we have the plasma going from a gas nozzle on the inside to one on the outside? We didn't really expect that, but that's what it obviously does. And also, these things are very collimated. The diameter is roughly the same along the length, whereas the magnetic field is getting weaker as you go outside. And in principle, if we're just following the vacuum field, it should be much wider on the outside. So I'll get back to that later.
What are we actually looking at in that?
Visible light.
It's
probably H alpha light in that case. It may have been another gas, in which case I forget what that picture was. It may have been nitrogen or neon plasma, in which case it was a singly ionized atomic line. Okay, so one can explain in a hand-waving sort of way what's going on based on simple MHD physics, saying that parallel currents attract and anti-parallel currents repel. So we've got current flowing up here, and so there's current going down here and current going up here, and so these guys repel each other. That's one way of looking at it, a very simple way. And so these spider legs will get bigger. They'll bulge out. I mean, you all know that. In the fusion world, this is called the hoop force, and it's J. Gillespie force. There's 10 different ways of looking at it. Okay, so here are spider legs moving out, and then the next thing that happens is that they merge to form what we call a central column, because parallel currents attract, so these guys attract each other, and they'll merge together to form a single central column. So we see that, and here you can see it starting to merge. And then we get a jet-like axial expansion of the central column, and that's what we claim is the astrophysical jet, the simulated astrophysical jet. So it extends, and what's, again, there's lots of ways of looking at this, but one way is to say there's toroidal field in here and the pressure that's pushing it out. Another way is to say there's J. Gillespie forces pushing it out. is a gradient of B phi squared, pushing it out, all equivalent. So we were at this point, and then it does that, okay? So we claim that's a pretty reasonable replica of MHD astrophysical jet. And we've made some Doppler shift measurements. If we look from this end, so it's coming towards us, we see a blue shift, and if we look in a window from the back, we'll see a red shift. And the scale of the thing can be seen just by looking at this image. That's sort of what the rough scale is. So the idea was that the vacuum chamber is really big, and so it's not interacting with the walls of the vacuum chamber. It's really in empty space. So here's an example of the Doppler shift data. For reference, here's an H beta and deuterium beta lines. And the red is the red shift, and the blue is the blue shifted. And for this particular case, there was about a 10 kilometer per second velocity. And we see motional velocities of that order with our camera. So we see velocities between 10 and 50 kilometers per second, depending on how we run it and what gas we're using.
How does that compare with the
advanced
speed?
Well, that's an interesting question. We thought that always that was small compared to the Alphane speed. But it's something we'll have to look at again, because our densities in some cases get to be a lot higher than what we thought, and so the Alphane speed might be lower than what we thought. So it's either a fraction of the Alphane speed or of the order of the Alphane speed.
What's your density going after?
We have two diagnostics. One that was kind of fortuitous, Stark broadening, and then the other is a more classical laser interferometer, and they're agreeing with each other. We wouldn't really see Stark broadening unless we had really high densities. Okay. So the next thing that happens is there's a kink instability of the central column, and that happens when it gets to certain lengths. So the kink instability is sketched here. So if it gets to a critical length, then it does something like that. And so here's a photograph of it undergoing a kink. And we've studied that in great detail.
Looks like a beautiful.
Yeah. So here's a movie of this thing. The spider leg part isn't very visible here, because the spider legs are much dimmer than the rest. You have to change the camera sensitivity to see the spider legs. But basically, you can see how it starts off with the spider legs, they merge, and we get a jet, and it's pretty darn collimated, and then it kinks. And it's quite reproducible. In fact, this particular movie was made out of three shots. So our camera only takes 16 frames, and this is 48 frames. So we took one shot, took 16 frames, and then we changed the camera trigger to be a little later, and took another shot and another one. So this is really stitched together from three different shots, and you don't see much of jerkiness at that. So it's plenty reproducible. And so we can turn knobs up and down. We acquired a movie camera that made this, I guess, a couple of years ago now, and that's been a great boon, because before we were taking single shots. It was very hard to, very tedious to do that. But now we just take a picture and look at the movie and adjust something and look at the movie again. So here's a picture of a kink. This is, I think, a reasonably persuasive kink. And the kink instability is determined by this quantity Q being equal to 1. If you know about tokamaks, you know all about Q. And in a tokamak, this would be the toroidal field, and this would be the poloidal field. In our case, this is like taking a tokamak and stretching it, making it a straight Z-pinch. So in a tokamak, what happens is that if you make the poloidal magnetic field too strong, then it's unstable. That's like running too much toroidal current, and it kinks. In our case, this B phi that comes from the axial current, and it kinks. In a tokamak, the dimensions are fixed, but in our case, the length is changing. So BZ and B phi and R are all staying roughly the same, but our jet is getting longer and longer. So when it starts off short, Q is bigger than 1. And then when it gets to a critical length, Q is equal to 1, and boom, it goes unstable. And this doesn't have any mass dependence in it, so it's just a threshold, whereas the jet behavior depends on mass. So we can play games in having the kink occur earlier or later. The kink physics is very distinct from the jet physics.
What is L?
The length of it. I've got it up here.
Okay. Oh, right, okay.
And R is like the nominal radius for this thing. Okay, so now I want to talk about a collimation model that I have worked on that really came out of these experiments and some other experiments we did, and also solar physicists telling me they were all worried about collimation. So this is an attempt at a universal model of collimation. And the claim is that collimation...
Solar physicists want to collimate?
What? The solar coronal loops are very collimated, like the trace photographs are very collimated. Actually uniform, if you want.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So my claim is that the collimation is a result of flow stagnation, and it's a finite beta effect, and you won't get it in a zero beta model, which is what people often use for these things. So the relevant equations are, again, some MHD equations. I'll discuss these in detail as we get to them. And I'm going to go to a slightly different geometry for now. This is one that's more relevant to the solar case, but it's easier to build up your intuition in this geometry. And then later I'll go back to the astrophysical jet case, because this has a little bit more symmetry in it, and it's easier to see what's going on. Okay. So I'm going to, topologically this is the same thing, but geometrically it's a little different. So I imagine that I've got a flux tube which is actually non-uniform to start off with. So the diameter of the flux tube is larger at the middle than at the ends. And I have some kind of electromotive force which drives a current along this flux tube. Okay. And I'm going to argue that what happens is pretty complicated, and that there's three distinct stages. And I call these the twisting stage, which occurs when the current is rising, the axial thrust stage, which occurs when the current is steady, but the system is not in dynamic equilibrium. And then the third stage, the stagnation stage, is the stage where the system develops a dynamic an equilibrium. So the first stage is the twisting stage where the current's rising, so there's a di by dt. And so if we think of the field lines on this flux tube, and we define S as the distance along a field line from the midplane, then if you run a current along this thing, that current is going to make a toroidal field, and that'll be superimposed on this field, and it'll get, and so you'll wind up with twisted field lines. Okay. So the axial current twists the flux tube, it creates a B phi, and the plasma in this is going to rotate around. If you work out the dynamics, and it rotates around in just such a way that the plasma behaves as if it's frozen to a field line. Okay, that's what the dynamics does. That's basically Alphine wave physics. And the key is that there's no flow velocity, nothing moving in this direction. It's just toroidal velocity at this stage. So if you take the induction equation and you write out its toroidal component, you find that there's three terms. This is the dB phi by dt, and I just argued that the poloidal velocity was zero. That poloidal, I mean, in the r and z directions. So these two terms are zero, and all you're left with is this term, and b poloidal dot grad, that's like the derivative along a field line. So if you integrate this with respect to S, the distance along the field line, you can calculate what u phi is, and you get the Alphinic kind of twisting velocity. So here's that solution. So you see, when S is equal to zero, it doesn't move. There has to be some symmetry assumptions. Something's got to tell you what's moving and what isn't moving. But when S is positive, it twists in one sense. And when S is negative, it twists in the opposite sense. And that's how you get this kind of twisting motion. And it's proportional to di by dt. And if you were to integrate this with respect to time, then the toroidal displacement would just be proportional to the toroidal magnetic field. And you find that the plasma is frozen to the field lines, and so on and so on. Okay. So that's the first stage. Now, the second stage, I'm going to say, at this stage, my current is now steady. Okay, so di by dt is zero. So I don't have any more of these twists. It's already twisted. It's made its toroidal displacement. But I'm going to argue that there are some flows in this case, because if our flux tube just twisted, it still had a bulge in it, and so the pinch force, it's caused by J cross B poking in, and J cross B is going to be at an angle, because it's perpendicular to J, which is like that, and B, which is like that, And it's also going to be stronger, which is shown by the larger arrows here at the ends, than you go to the middle. It's sort of like the sausage instability kind of argument. So because these are tilted, they have a horizontal component, and so they're going to give you a force that goes from both ends to the middle. And even the current is just going from left to right here. It doesn't matter what the direction of the current is. I could reverse the direction of the current. I still get the same forces, because J and B would both reverse signs if I reverse the current direction. Also, if you look at the radial force balance, there'll be a radial equilibrium. And since these arrows are longer here, you've got a higher pressure here. So you'll have a higher on-axis pressure over here than over here. Okay. So the radial force balance is kind of like squeezing a toothpaste tube, and that will squeeze out the toothpaste. And so you get these flows on the axis from both ends to the center. So the current's constant, there's no plasma rotation at this stage, and we have flows going from both ends to the center. So if we take a look at an individual fluid element shown by this toroid, these toroids are going to be accelerated from both ends to the middle. And that brings me to the third stage, the stagnation stage, okay, which is what happens when they get to the middle. So when they get to the middle, there's, first of all, I hypothesize that there'll be some kind of a kinetic side effect. This is like the tail on the dog. But there'll be some particles that just happen to bounce back and forth between these approaching fluid elements, and they'll get accelerated in Fermi style, and so you might expect there'll be an energetic tail created. Okay. Now, let's talk about the collision between these fluid elements. Well, they were moving, and when they bump into each other, they stop moving, so their translational kinetic energy gets converted into heat, so you get a heating of the plasma. Secondly, these guys had magnetic flux frozen into them. You can think of the toroidal magnetic field lines as being like elastic bands that are frozen into the fluid elements. Okay, that's what provides the pinch force. When these things smash into each other, we're going to increase the density of those elastic bands. That's going to increase the toroidal field. So we're going to get an amplification of B phi because of the axial compression of these things. So the toroidal field lines are like the dimples on this car. They get squeezed together in the collision, and we get an increased toroidal field. So if we go back to the toroidal component of the induction equation at this stagnation layer, for this problem, euploidal is zero at the stagnation layer. When I go to astrophysical jets, I'm going to bring this over to the left-hand side and make a convective derivative. And then I'll say in the frame moving with the poloidal velocity, then we don't have to worry about this term. Okay, but in this case, it's just zero from symmetry. And I said u phi was zero because I is constant, and you only get a u phi when the current is changing. And so all we're left with is this last term. And so the induction equation reduces to this. And since we have converging flows, the divergence of the velocity, del dot u poloidal, is negative, and so we get an amplification of b phi. Okay, so we get toroidal field amplification. So that's just a mathematical way of expressing those dimples on the car. So if we write down our induction equation at this point, and if we write down the mass conservation equation at this point, there was a term that disappears because of the symmetry. So at this point, this is what the mass conservation equation is. We can eliminate del dot u between these two, and we find that b phi increases in proportion to the density. Okay, and that makes reasonable sense, because if magnetic field lines are frozen into the plasma, and if you're accumulating plasma at the center, then you've got to be accumulating the magnetic field that's frozen into the plasma. And if the density of the plasma goes up, the density of the field lines has got to go up. And so the magnetic field should increase in proportion to the accumulation of stuff there. And this whole thing depends on compressibility. If you use an incompressible model, you wouldn't get any of this. Pardon? There's another term that disappears because of the symmetry at this point. Here. We can look at the math after. I don't want to get... Okay. Okay, so I've shown that the flow stagnation tends to amplify b toroidal, b phi, but Ampere's law says that 2 pi r times b toroidal is mu naught I, and I was fixed. That's the current that I'm putting in my system through my electrodes. So if I is fixed and b phi is going up, then r's got to decrease. So the bulge goes away, and I get collimation. And if you think of it in terms of these elastic bands, I'm squirting elastic bands from both ends to the middle, and I'm accumulating lots of elastic bands at the middle, and so that's going to squeeze down the middle. So here's a summary picture of this. Here's the current, the J cross B force. Here's a fluid element. It's getting squirted in. It's going to pull along the poloidal field with it also, because the poloidal field is frozen into it. And so you get this sort of thing. And there's high pressure at the ends and low pressure there. And it's self-limiting. Once it gets to be actually uniform, then the J cross B force will be pointing radially inwards, and there won't be any more thrust. So it has a sort of a finish point. Once it gets to be actually uniform, then it's happy, and it doesn't change anymore. So if you go to astrophysical jet geometry.
I'm sorry, let's go back to that.
Sure.
It's very nice picture. Just to understand what's happening. So is this true that when you say asymptotes to make it uniform, does that imply a lot of wave traversals back and forth from?
This is, I think it could be. I mean, this is being done on a very slow basis. I think the analogy I like to think of would be to be filling up a bathtub with water that's dripping in over the walls. So it'll slowly fill up, and then once it fills up, won't fill anymore once it gets to the same level as what you're filling it with. And it doesn't really matter how fast you do it, as long as it isn't leaking, it'll eventually fill up. So I don't think that there's any intrinsic speed involved here. This is meant to be a very slow process.
The bathtub is not, I'm afraid I saw the baby with the water, so let me go back to this.
Okay.
You require symmetry is important in reading, if I can exactly get cancellation.
Well, it's not, as I said, I could go to a moving frame, and in that frame, what's really important is to have a converging flow. Del dot u being negative, that's the critical thing.
A statement about how asymptotically it converges to this uniform symmetry.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. You have to have this symmetry for it to get to be uniform in this case.
So you can allow enough time for a plane waves to travel back and forth.
Yeah. So that's why I'm saying I'm doing it slowly. So if we go to an astrophysical jet kind of geometry, which relates more to my experiment, as I said, there are lots of ways of looking at the acceleration. But one way of looking at it is to say you've got J cross B forces that are at an angle here. So you get a horizontal component that's pushing out. And if you write out the mathematics, you get the axial derivative of B phi squared is a term that's pushing it to the right, the gradient of the toroidal field squared. But that doesn't work on the axis, because the toroidal field is zero on the axis. So on the axis, what you have to work with is the fact that there's going to be a radial pressure balance, and you'll have a high pressure over here, so it gets squirted out like the toothpaste tube on the axis. So between the two of them, you get that, and you can combine them and get something. So now you get this flow out. There also, in principle, should be some flow coming out this side too, but it'll be much weaker, because the current is getting bigger. Or at least the flux tube is getting bigger on this side, but so there'd be a weak flow, or maybe not much of a flow. But in any case, the velocity isn't going to be the same going all the way around this field line. Okay, so there'll be some local reduction in velocity as you go there, and so that's going to give you the negative del dot u somewhere or other there. So I'd argue that somewhere around here, there's going to be a place where del dot u is negative. If you think of it as the elastic bands, we've got elastic bands here, and we're squirting them out. And somewhere, they're accumulating. And when they accumulate, they'll squeeze it down, and it will become collimated. But then it's not, it's flowing out here. So that's going to give us more flows, and we'll shoot more elastic bands out, and they'll squeeze down. And we can just keep on doing that, and we'll get longer and longer and get collimated. And so I think that's sort of what's happening here, is that we're shooting out our elastic bands, and they're sticking somewhere around there. it's getting collimated. Of course, I think in the jet it never really gets fully collimated because it doesn't ever settle down, but there's this tendency towards getting collimated.
Is it significant in your two slides back? To get this stagnation or stagnation in the flow frame, you got this J cross B force pushing in, and with Newton's third law, I've got to have a reaction somewhere.
So yeah, so there's a pressure.
It's crucial that your magnetic structure is then goes off and is tied to the annulus on the outside.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the current, there's an assumption that there's an electric circuit here with a current that's flowing and it's and there's a magnetic field.
This is still happening. The whole stagnation and squashing down, collimation is happening on time. It's slow compared to alpha transit times from your stagnation region out to the
I think so.
Field line tied back the end.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll skip. You've seen the movie. Okay, so let me go to an even more.
Exactly stagnating.
Pardon?
So what is stagnating there? Is it a velocity or what is actually?
Oh well, I think the argument is that there is that del dot u is negative somewhere. Okay, if del dot u being negative is really a frame independent concept. Okay, because it means there's stuff accumulating. Somewhere you can. Okay, so if you have del dot u being negative, then that means that there's the u is the matter flow, but there's magnetic field lines attached to that matter, so there's going to be an accumulation of magnetic field lines wherever you have del dot u negative.
Seems like it's kind of crucial. Essentially, you're having a puffing out all of these whoops of field, and you're getting a whoop stress that's squashing down on stuff.
Yeah, that's the pinch force. That's the elastic bands. Yeah.
So maybe you can
Pardon?
I didn't understand the stagnation. I understood the previous diagram, but this one I didn't.
Okay. Well, I admit I'm speculating a little bit here, but I'm saying that if let's imagine that there is no stagnation, okay? Let's say that I'm all full of baloney. There's no stagnation. Then you'd have but then you'd have to have the same velocity all along a field line, okay? Which I don't think we have. We're not square. The stuff isn't flowing. If you think of this as being like a garden hose. Okay, here's a garden hose and it's going around like that. If we were squirting water in this garden hose and there was no stagnation, then the water would come right out the back. Okay, but it's not in our experiment. We're either squirting stuff a little bit in here or not, but we don't have stuff squirting out the back. So we're filling this up with stuff. Okay, and if we're filling it up with stuff, we're also filling it up with toroidal field lines, which are those elastic bands.
But in the usual picture that when I take a flux tip and I twist it, the twist goes to the region of the weakest field, which would be the edge, and therefore it will expand, which is what we call it. I take a thin line loop and I twist it, I create a twist, and the twist propagates. You can think of it as a
I'm pulse. Doing it slower. I'm doing it really slow, so I'm not.
Never mind. I mean, you can establish a final state.
No, the twist. I have an analogy. If I turn on the lights switch here, the lights turn on right away. Okay. If you wanted to be pedantic about it, you could say, well, there's a wave that has to travel from the light switch to the lights, and let's follow that. That's the Alphine wave. I'm not worrying about that. I'm saying I turn on the light switch, and there's a current along the whole length of it, and that gives me a B phi everywhere. And so I just have B phi.
So by stagnation, it seems to me, using the word stagnation, you have a region here where the velocity is decreasing in the direction
It's like traveling on the highway at 70 miles an hour and hitting traffic that's going 65 miles an hour.
Paul, one of your problems you're having is that you're using the word stagnation, which comes across to people
as stopping. Okay, it's not stopping.
What you're really having is that the compressional stress that's happening here,
okay,
at these cerebral loops, is squashing down and causing stuff to do just like,
okay,
the traffic thing,
okay,
causing it to decelerate.
Okay, okay. Well, maybe you're right. With stagnation in the solar case here, maybe stagnation isn't the best word. But, okay.
I think accelerating flow and stagnation together.
Okay. Okay. Okay, well, I got to figure. I should come up with better words. Okay, so here's one of these solar loops, which is very collimated, and this is a big mystery in solar physics, so this was an attempt to do that. And here's another experiment that maybe some of you have seen, because one of my students gave a talk on this here a couple of years ago, where we were simulating solar coronal loops, and you can see they're also very collimated along the lines. Oops. Yikes. And then our spider legs were very collimated, and our jet is very collimated. So my argument is that there's a tremendous tendency to be collimated no matter what situation you're in. Okay. So now I want to talk about the some more details. I want to talk about the current J. So I'm going to define a flux-based coordinate system, right-handed coordinate system, where the unit vector e psi is in the direction normal to the poietal flux. E phi, that's the usual toroidal unit vector, and E poloidal is orthogonal to these two. So this is sort of an extension of the radial direction, and this is like an extension of the axial direction, but it's in the local coordinates of the flux system. So if I use this, then it's convenient because B psi is zero by definition, because the magnetic field is given by this and doesn't have any component there. So my magnetic field could be wiggling around and this will always be zero. So it's helpful when dealing with forces because you can always set B psi to zero. So here's what it looks like. Here's E psi is normal to the flux surface. This is the toroidal one and this is the one along those field lines. That's when they're untwisted. So one can take the current and calculate all its components. And what's interesting is that there's different physics for the different components. This is what can cause a great deal of confusion because you talk about the current does, and the fact is that the current does different things, very different things, depending on which component you're talking about. So I'll go through this. So J psi is, I'll argue, is the polarization current that you study in plasma physics, and it's completely determined by the time derivative of the current. And it vanishes when the current is constant, and when it's constant, then I becomes a function of psi, and you get back the Gratz-Shafranov kind of solution. So this is kind of a dependent variable. It depends on the rate of change of I. J phi, you can show, is given by this expression. So it's just an immediate function of psi. If you specify psi, that immediately tells you what J phi is. Okay, so and also the induction equation looks like this, and it tells you that if there's no flows, the flows correspond to U poloidal, then the poloidal flux is constant. Okay, so the only way you can change this is, I think, a very powerful statement because it says the only way you can get rid of a bulge is to have a poloidal flow. Okay, and then finally, this one is the one that flows along the flux tube. This is like roughly the axial one, and that's the one that you impose externally. That's the current that's coming off my electrodes provided by my power supply. That's the one I can control. I can turn it up and down. So if we look at the J psi physics, this relates to some of the stuff I was talking about earlier when I was getting on people's nerves. Saying this is essentially the polarization current, and this is going in this direction, and when it's crossed with B, it gives you an acceleration that in that direction. That's what causes the plasma to rotate and twist up, and it's the rotation is E cross B drift, so this is what starts the E cross B drift. And if we look at it in terms of particles, then here are here are ions doing an E cross B drift because there's a radioelectric field, and electrons doing an E cross B drift because there's a radioelectric field. When you turn on that radioelectric field, the ions go one way, the electrons go the other way, so there's a charge separation, and it's that charge separation, which is the polarization, and that motion, relative motion of ions in one direction and electrons in the other direction is the polarization current. Okay, so that's what makes MHD work. Gives you at least twisting motions in MHD, you get this polarization. And the plasma is like a capacitor because you've got charge of one sign over here and charge of another sign over there. And then when the current goes down, then you get a deceleration and everything comes to a halt and you've rotated the plasma by some finite amount. Okay, so that's why this current, at least why the azimuth of velocity, the toroidal velocity, is related to turning on this current and turning it off. So if you look at it mathematically, and I'll whiz through this, it takes too long to go through the details, but I'll just show you what the details are. This is the toroidal component of the equation of motion, and there's no beep psi by definition, and there's no pressure in the toroidal direction, so this is the only term. And if you solve this for J psi, then you get the polarization current. And U phi is what I solved for earlier from the induction equation. And if you combine all these things, you get J psi goes like the time derivative of E psi. That's the usual polarization current that you study in plasma particle drifts. And it's also like a capacitor. If you work with electronics, you know there's a current that goes like I is equal to C dV by dt. And so this is the I, and this is the dV by dt, and this is the capacitance. And it also goes like the second derivative of I. So I think it nailed down that J psi is this transience dependent, and it's necessarily like an AC current. So you can't have a steady state current perpendicular to the field lines. Otherwise, you'll charge up the plasma infinitely. Now this one, as I say, just comes from taking the curl of the magnetic field, and it's related to this equation, and it tells you that it's related to flows. Initially, we have a vacuum field, so initially this is zero, so there isn't any current, and then when we squeeze it together, we get some current, and then when it becomes straight, this actually goes away. And then this is the one that we drive externally. It's the independence drive. That's the whatever your source of EMF is driving. So I'd like to say a little bit about the stagnation. The simple-minded way of looking at the accelerating force is that it goes like the axial derivative of B phi squared. I mean, I'm not worried about the toothpaste effect. But so you can think of this B phi squared as being like a potential. This is a gradient of a potential, and so you can think of the plasma falling down a potential well, and when it falls down to the bottom, it's going to get a kinetic energy that corresponds to this. So when the plasma gets to the middle, it's going to have an axial velocity that corresponds to that potential. So the sort of velocity you would expect to get out of this will be an alphanic kind of velocity, but using the toroidal magnetic field, which is the weak field, so you get a field that's slower than that. And the astrophysical jet case, it might be more complicated. This is more for the solar case. Then when you have the stagnation, this flow gets thermalized. And so this kinetic energy, 1/2 rho uz squared, is going to get turned into thermal energy. And so that will give me the pressure. And so I can calculate a beta from this, because now I know the pressure. And this b squared was the total field, which is mainly the poloidal field. And since P goes like B phi squared, and this goes like B poloidal squared, I wind up with a beta that's proportional to B phi over B poloidal, all squared, which is like the pitch of the system. So argue that this thing will tend to settle down to a beta that goes like the pitch squared. And in equilibrium, which would be the case in the solar case, I don't think the astrophysical one really gets to equilibrium, but in the solar case, you'd get an equilibrium like that. And so that you can write that in terms of a Gratz-Shafranov equation using flux coordinates. And so this equation becomes this. You get an equation involving psi and p and I. And the Gratz-Shafranov analysis shows that I and p are functions of psi. And we can define Psi-naught is the surface in which the pressure vanishes, and we can assume the simplest situation where we have linear dependence on psi. So this would be the simplest non-trivial pressure dependence, one where the pressure peaks on the axis and goes to zero on the edge, and it linearly depends on psi. And similarly, we can let I be a linear function of psi. This is similar to what you assume for force-free situation, except we're not making it force-free. We're a little bit beyond force-free. And so if you do that, these are sort of the simplest ones, and you write the Gradshoff-Rondeff equation in a dimensionless form, you find that the pressure term shows up as a forcing type term, an inhomogeneous term on the right-hand side. This is the I di by d psi term, and this is the Laplacian type of term. And beta shows up there, so this depends on finite beta, and the flux is normalized to the peak flux. So an interesting thing about this equation is that it has a particular solution. Namely, if you match this term and this term, then you find that psi goes like r squared. And if psi goes like r squared, then this term goes away. And if psi goes like r squared, then this term goes away also, because d psi by dr goes like r, and it'll cancel the 1 over r there. So psi being equal to something times r squared is a solution of this, and that's the particular solution. And the interesting thing about that solution is that it's axially uniform, and that that would correspond to some kind of critical beta. So that'll be the only solution that'll satisfy the boundary conditions if you have this beta. You can't have any other solutions because they won't. This will satisfy the boundary conditions, and if you add any homogeneous solution to it, you'll muck up the boundary conditions. So this is the only solution you can have if you have this critical beta. And if you have that critical beta, then it's got to be actually uniform. But that beta is exactly the beta you get from the flow stagnation. So the system is tending to make that beta. And so if it gets to that beta, then it's going to become actually uniform. So I argue that this explains why the solar coronal loops are actually uniform, and why our experiment was, and why the spider legs were, and why our jet is tending that way. It doesn't really get there, but it's trying to do that. And that's it. So let me conclude by saying that the twisting goes like the distance you are from your symmetry point times di by dt. And so it's a linear function of I. Whereas the axial flow, uz, goes like the time integral of the acceleration. And the acceleration goes like d by dz of b phi squared, which goes like I squared. So it's a nonlinear function of I. And so I argue that the flow has to occur later because it's an integral of this, whereas this is like an instantaneous thing. And then this accumulation of plasma at the pileup point, the midplane in the solar case, will cause your elastic bands to build up and give you more pinch force and give you axial uniformity. There'll be some bulk heating because of the flow. There'll be some creation of energetic particles, perhaps, because of converging flows. And it's self-limiting. Once it becomes axial uniform, then it's happy, because what's driving it is the axial non-uniformity. And the Gradshoff-Rondeff analysis showed that this magic beta corresponds to an axially uniform solution of the Gradshoff-Rondeff equation. Is if you get that beta, it's got to be actually uniform. Okay, thank you.